Welcome and good evening. Tonight we're going to present Sleep and MS, Strategies for Improving Your Z's. This webinar and tele-learning series is brought to you by Can Do Multiple Sclerosis and the National Multiple Sclerosis Society as part of our monthly series. My name is Laura Coyne, and I'm the Programs Manager for Can Do MS. I will be your moderator this evening. Can Do MS transforms lives. We deliver educational programs on exercise, nutrition, and symptom management to inspire and motivate long-lasting change for those with MS and their families to help them thrive. Please visit the Can Do MS website, mscandu.org, to learn more about Can Do MS's online and nationwide in-person programs. The mission of the National MS Society is to help people affected with MS live their best lives as they stop MS in its tracks, restore what has been lost, and end MS forever. You can explore other society's programs, services, resources, and connection opportunities at nationalmssociety.org. We will save about 10 to 15 minutes at the end of this webinar for questions and answers. If you do have a question, please post them in the chat feature located on the left of your computer screen. To submit a question, type in a small box that says chat with your presenters, and I would like to encourage you to be part of this interactive discussion. This presentation is being recorded and will be archived on the Can Do MS and the National MS Society's websites. Because this is being recorded, all telephone lines have been muted. With us tonight to discuss a variety of approaches for assessing and managing sleep disturbances in MS is a neurology nurse practitioner, Stephanie Buxhoveden, and a psychologist, Abby J. Hughes. Stephanie was diagnosed with relapsing remitting multiple sclerosis at the beginning of her career. She became an MS certified nurse and began working in the same MS center where she was a patient. She now works as a neurology nurse practitioner and specializes in the care of people living with MS, Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, migraines, and epilepsy. Abby is a clinical psychologist trained in health psychology, neuropsychology, and rehabilitation psychology. She is currently an assistant professor in the Department of Physical Medicine and Rehabilitation Medicine at the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. Thank you for joining us for this presentation of Sleep and MS, Strategies for Improving Your Z's. And with that, I'm going to turn the meeting over to Stephanie.
Hi, everybody, and good evening. We're really excited to have everybody on the line with us tonight. And we wanted to start tonight's presentation off with a polling question. So we want to know what sleep issues that you struggle with most often. And I want you to check all that apply to you, whether that's falling asleep, staying asleep, waking up too early, feeling tired throughout the day, winding down for sleep, or getting comfortable at bedtime. So go ahead and select those results, and I'm going to give everybody a minute to respond. Results. So it looks like a lot of you identified staying asleep and feeling tired throughout the day, as well as falling asleep and waking up too early. But still, a lot of us have issues with winding down to sleep and getting comfortable at bedtime. So I'm really glad that you joined us tonight, because we're going to hit on all of these issues during our webinar. So the first thing that I want to talk about are the two different types of sleep dysfunction. So first, there's primary sleep dysfunction, and this is an alteration in our normal sleep-wake cycle that can't be attributed to any other cause. Whereas secondary sleep dysfunction is a sleep disturbance caused by medical, behavioral, or environmental factors. So it probably doesn't come as a surprise, but this is the most common issue in people who have MS. There are a lot of MS symptoms that can interfere with sleep. So first and foremost, pain and muscle spasticity are both really uncomfortable, and they can make it incredibly hard to fall asleep. Spasticity can cause these jerking limb motions that can make it difficult to fall asleep and can actually wake us up in the middle of our night's rest. In addition, we know people with MS have a much higher incidence of depression and anxieties in the general population, and one of the most common symptoms of depression and anxiety is actually sleep disturbance. So either hypersomnia, getting too much sleep, or insomnia, having trouble falling asleep. And Abby's really going to dive into great detail, and she has a couple of really great exercises coming up that I'm very excited for. Also, bowel and bladder dysfunction. So if you're getting up to use the bathroom several times a night, you're obviously not going to get a full restful night's sleep. And temperature sensitivity. This is a huge issue for so many of us. Either being too hot or too cold can worsen our symptoms. And if you're getting really hot and sweaty throughout the night, you're going to wake up uncomfortable. So that's definitely going to interfere with your sleep. So with that, I want to kind of turn it over to Abby now and have her dive into some of those topics a little more in depth.
Thank you, Stephanie. Welcome, everyone, and thank you for having me. I'd like to start with this next polling question. If you are joining just by phone, you won't be able to participate in the poll. However, if you're joining through webinar, let's go ahead and think about this next question here. Have you brought up your concerns about sleep with your healthcare provider? And this could be your neurologist, your primary care doctor, really anyone that you see. Have you brought up those issues at all? And go ahead and select which one may apply to you. And I'll give you a minute to do so. Okay, so just with what we have here, it seems like there's a pretty good split between folks who have maybe brought this up in the past 6 months or not at all. So this may be a more recent problem for you, or maybe you haven't brought it up because you have such limited time with your provider and maybe this issue isn't prioritized. Hopefully after tonight's talk, you may have some resources at your disposal, but then you can bring this to your provider and have a discussion about that. All right. I did want to spend a little time discussing the many different kinds of sleep disorders that can affect people with MS. Stephanie talked a little bit about this with regard to hypersomnia or sleeping too much, but I wanted to give you some of the terms that are commonly used within the sleep literature and within the sleep medicine areas so that, you know, potentially you can ask your provider about these. The issue that most commonly faces people with MS is insomnia, and this is difficulty falling asleep, difficulty staying asleep, or waking too early in the morning. So this would be, say, maybe you don't have trouble falling asleep or staying asleep, but you're waking up at 4 o'clock in the morning and then you're just starting your day at that point because you can't resume sleep and you'd rather sleep a couple more hours. With hypersomnia, that's sleeping too much. So you may find that you're sleeping 9 or 10 hours per night, maybe upwards of 12 or 13 hours, and you're not feeling rested upon waking. And that's really the key for the hypersomnia, is that no matter how much sleep you get, it's probably more than you had earlier in your life and you're still not feeling rested. There's also a significant prevalence of breathing-related sleep disorders in people with MS. This includes what's called central sleep apnea and obstructive sleep apnea. If you've ever had a sleep test or a sleep study done and had this diagnosis, you may have been recommended for something like a CPAP machine if you were diagnosed with sleep apnea. And we know that the CPAP machine is the number one treatment for obstructive sleep apnea. And for a variety of reasons, people with MS are at risk for developing these breathing-related sleep disorders, particularly if you've had decreased mobility or decreased physical activity. Increased weight gain can also put additional stress on the trachea and where you are able to get air through in the night. And so there's structural and mechanical issues that can actually interfere with your breathing in the night due to MS. From a central sleep apnea perspective, lesions in the brain in particular locations can also alter breathing patterns. So it's not a bad idea that if you are having difficulty with sleep to get a sleep study to rule out some of these various diagnoses. There are also sleep-wake disorders. So this would be where, you know, your circadian rhythm may be disrupted. If you've been a shift worker in your life, this could also contribute to a sleep-wake disorder where your nights and days are a little bit mixed up. I've seen this comment in the side chat panel a little bit already with regard to restless legs and body syndrome. This is something that's incredibly common in MS, It can interfere with difficulty falling asleep, but it also can wake you up in the night with regard to the restless legs. Less common in MS is something like narcolepsy, and this is a very sudden urge to fall asleep during the day, much more so than feeling drowsy or taking a nap, but it's essentially a sleep attack where you're suddenly overcome by the irresistible urge to sleep. This is sometimes due to a vitamin deficiency or a lesion to a particular area of the brain that can trigger that. Much more rare in people with MS, but it's still included on the list. And then finally, we have sleep behavior disorders, and this is where, you know, usually we go through different stages of sleep throughout the night. But as we, depending on if you have certain lesions or other factors, different medications can disrupt that, those stages of sleep. And so you may start acting out various behaviors, like acting out your dreams in your sleep. Sleep eating or sleepwalking can be included in those sleep behavior disorders. So I just wanted to orient everyone to how many different aspects of sleep can be impacted, particularly in MS, so that when you are talking to your provider, you can be specific about the kinds of symptoms that you're experiencing. I also wanted to talk a little bit about the consequences of poor sleep. This is a laundry list of things that we know are linked to insomnia, and there's lots of good research to support this. But as you can see, this is particularly relevant for people with MS, with regard to depression, irritability and anxiety, pain and fatigue. You know, with fatigue, we know that affects over 90% of people with MS, and it's a primary consequence of poor sleep potentially. So if there's an opportunity to improve sleep, that could have significant implications for improving your fatigue as well. One of the things that I'm concerned with is also problems with physical coordination and risk of falls. We just don't want to be adding any additional risk of falls for people with MS. So as much as we can improve sleep, we hope to reduce the risk of falls. One of my interests is also in neuropsychology and MS. And whenever I'm working with patients, I always want to get a good assessment of thinking, concentration, and general cognitive functioning. And I'm always asking about sleep just because, you know, when you think you have a series of several bad nights of sleep and then you go in for a cognitive evaluation, you're probably not at your best, and that's important for me to know as a provider. And then just our last three here, poor work or driving risks. There's cardiovascular health problems that have been linked to poor sleep. And then overall, just long-term poor health outcomes. So a lot of these probably don't come too much as a surprise to everyone, but I think it's helpful to list these so that we know really that sleep is such an important health behavior that we don't prioritize enough. So now what you can do to help your sleep, which is the focus of tonight's talk, I wanted to talk a little bit about each of the areas that I work with folks for. It looks like my... So physical activity, this is probably one of the number one things that we really want to encourage people with MS to try to have regularly throughout their week. If you're already doing regular physical activity, that's wonderful. I want to encourage you to continue doing that. And also keep in mind that sometimes the timing of your physical activity can alter your sleep. So if you're not currently in an exercise routine, starting with a low intensity but higher frequency activity. So, for example, walking, biking, swimming, just a few minutes per day even could be helpful, or a few minutes every other day. ChairFit with Nancy is also a great resource. If you go to YouTube, it's a whole channel with various physical activity exercises for people with MS. So that's one that I found that patients have really enjoyed. And then the National Center on Health, Physical Activity, and Disability. It's a free 14-week program where it's not quite couch to 5K, but it's a similar idea that you sign up free for a 14-week physical activity program. And it gives great ideas for different adaptations depending on your level of disability and what your needs are in terms of your physical activity. With physical activity, this is where you can try to improve your sleep through physical activity. Trying to complete the physical activity earlier in the day, exercise can be very energizing and stimulating, so that's great for managing your daytime fatigue. The downside to that is if you do your physical activity too close to bedtime, it may be actually more activating for you. So, again, maybe in the afternoon would be a better time. And pacing is also key. So doing too much too fast leads us all to burnout. This is not just for people with MS. This is for all of us. You know, if we're training for a marathon and we want to go out and try to run 10 miles, it's going to be a very punishing experience and we won't want to do it and we're less likely to succeed. So really pacing yourself, starting slow and low. That's usually like when you're, if anyone's a grilling master out there, when you want to cook, you know, a nice burnt end, you got to be slow and low. Same with physical activity. Other tools that can be helpful. I use the three words here, relaxation, meditation, and mindfulness. So these are three separate concepts. A lot of times the words relaxation, meditation, and mindfulness get interchanged, and they do correspond to different concepts, though. Relaxation is relaxing your body from kind of an overstimulated or a really active state. Meditation is generally seen as putting yourself into a different mindset. And meditation is generally a practice, you know, goes back to ancient Buddhist theory, ancient Buddhist times. So that's has a lot of history to it. And then with mindfulness, again, it's not the same as relaxation, but can still be helpful. You actually don't have to be relaxed in order to be mindful. However, all three of these, relaxation, meditation, and mindfulness, can be practices that may help with your sleep, depending on what you may gravitate towards. So I welcome you to look these different words up. The National MS Society has resources on all of these, and you may be able to find resources in your community for a meditation group or a mindfulness group that could also help with your sleep as well. Now, with behavioral sleep medicine, this is a fancy term for, you know, what can you do to help your sleep that doesn't necessarily involve medication. The premise behind behavioral sleep medicine is that our thoughts and actions have direct consequences on our sleep. So I'd like us all to do this activity. Thinking about a time when you couldn't sleep while lying in bed, what were you thinking about and what did you do about it? A lot of times, and I'm guilty of this as well, when you can't sleep and you're trying to sleep, you may put additional pressure on yourself and, you know, you may start looking at the clock and think, oh gosh, if I don't go to sleep in the next 5 minutes, I'm only going to get 6 hours of sleep. And then an hour later, I'm only going to get 5 hours of sleep. So having all of those, having all of those things happen, certainly won't help you. You may increase your anxiety. I'll move forward here. One of the behavioral medicine treatments for sleep is cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia. So it's called CBTI. I did want to spend a little time this evening just talking to you about what CBTI entails. This could easily take several hour-long seminars just to go over each component of the CBTI, but I just wanted to give you this information so that, one, you could ask your provider about it and see if it might be a good match for you. CBTI, so again, that's cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia. If you have other issues with sleep, it could also be helpful with that as well. It's composed of these various components that are sleep efficiency training, stimulus control, sleep hygiene, relaxation, and cognitive therapy. It's usually completed in 6 to 8 weeks with a psychologist or another trained healthcare professional. If you are a part of a major medical center, so I'm with Johns Hopkins, there is a Center for Behavioral Sleep Medicine that offers this therapy. But there's lots of, if you just Google CBTI, there's also some web-based tools that you can do CBTI on your own as well. And again, the nice part about CBTI is that it's generally brief. Again, 6 to 8 weeks with usually a weekly session. And it also has a homework component. So the first homework component is starting with a sleep diary. This was a attachment that was sent out to all of the audience this evening. And I wanted us all to go look at that together. The sleep diary that I sent out is from the National Sleep Foundation. And so I wanted us all to take a look at that together. And this is just a snapshot of the first page of the sleep diary. You'll see that there is a start date in the upper left-hand corner, and the first row along the top goes days 1 through days 7. The second row says, I went to bed last night at X time. So if you've already printed this out or if you have it on your computer, it may be helpful to start your sleep diary tonight and track your sleep for the next week. This is usually the starting place of any kind of CBTI treatment. It's also just helpful that for when you go to your provider to bring a sleep diary that shows your sleep over the past week. That can really help your provider kind of assess if there's certain days that you're having difficulty, certain times of the day, maybe certain factors that may be leading to more sleep disturbance. As you go through the sleep diary, you'll notice that there's half of it that is filled out in the morning and half of it that's filled out in the evening. So the one that's filled out in the morning usually has questions just about your sleep from the evening prior or the night prior. The other side you complete in the evening, and it asks you more questions about things that you did during the day that may alter your sleep. So, you know, how much caffeine did you have? Did you have any physical, did you engage in any physical activity? Those kinds of things. There's actually lots of different sleep diaries available online. If you just Google sleep diary, you'll see a few different ones come up. But this is one that I find pretty useful. And again, it's from the National Sleep Foundation and it is free. Just briefly going through the components of the sleep efficient or the CBTI, the sleep efficiency training piece is you want to maximize the ratio of the time you're asleep versus the time you're in bed. So I want you to think of maybe the past week or even just last night, for example. What time did you go to bed? And then what time did you get out of bed in the morning? I'll use just a general example. Let's say you went to bed at 10 p.m. and then you got out of bed at 8 a.m. So you were essentially in bed for 10 hours. How much of that time were you actually asleep? And let's say you were asleep for 8 of those hours. Your sleep efficiency would be 80% because you were asleep 8 hours out of the 10 hours you were in bed. That's an important number that you can calculate from your sleep diary, and over 85% is generally recommended. A lot of the general population is not getting that 85%. So that's also something, again, to talk to your provider about, because that will be a target of the CBTI. The other important key component of CBTI is what's called stimulus control. And so the picture that you see here, we see a woman sitting in bed who is sipping what I can assume to be maybe coffee or some kind of caffeinated beverage. She has her laptop on her bed. She has lots of paper strewn around and a whole tray of food, and the light is on as well. This is probably the opposite of stimulus control, or a good picture that shows what the opposite of stimulus control is. Stimulus control is the idea that the only thing we do in bed is sleep and sex. Anything beyond those activities is going to confuse our brain and let us be less likely to be able to fall asleep. So if you think about like flipping a coin, if you are only engaging in sleep or sex in bed, the chances of it being sleep is about 50%. That's a good odd. If you're adding other activities in bed like reading or eating or working, suddenly the chance of sleeping decreases significantly, and we want to maximize that chance of you sleeping in bed and not doing other things. So as much as we can, we want to minimize those other activities. Another thing, yes, using bed only for sleep and intimacy. Another component of CBTI is sleep hygiene. So these are strategies that we'll talk as we go through the webinar. But it seems like avoiding and minimizing naps as much as possible And I know when I talk to people, especially people with MS, naps are precious, right? Throughout the day, especially when you're managing the fatigue, naps may be the only way that you feel like you can get through the day. And so that's where working with a sleep specialist can really come in handy, because you can start to experiment and say, okay, what happens when I do, when I go a whole day without napping, and what's the worst that happens? Oftentimes you may find that you're able to fall asleep and stay asleep longer when you avoid and minimize the naps. Other aspects of sleep hygiene include avoiding stimulants too close to bedtime. So if you are taking a stimulant medication for your MS and for your fatigue, that's great. But taking it in the morning so that the effects of it are usually worn off by the time bedtime rolls around. And that's a good question for your prescriber to ask, is it okay? You know, when can I take this medication and how can I move that around my schedule so that I'm not feeling too stimulated as it gets closer to bedtime? Also avoiding large high carbohydrate foods before bedtime. Focusing on something that's more protein-based can help with sleep and help with maintaining sleep. Promoting natural light in your room and then creating a general bedtime routine as much as you can. And then the last components of CBTI is a relaxation training, which we will practice together later. And then there's a cognitive therapy component, that this is what you would be doing with a psychologist or a trained professional to help alter or change some of those maybe negative thoughts that you have about sleep. So again, when we're laying there thinking, oh gosh, if I don't get to sleep in the next 10 minutes, I'm just going to be worthless tomorrow. Or if I don't get my full 8 hours, I'm not going to be able to function tomorrow. Those are the kind of thoughts that we want to try to change through cognitive therapy, and a psychologist can be helpful with that. Back to the sleep hygiene, I just happened to see out of the corner of my eye someone asked about drinking liquids, and that was a great question I do want to add to the sleep hygiene piece. With regard to consuming liquids before bed, a lot of people with MS are on medications that cause additional thirst, or you may need to drink a lot of water throughout the day to manage your various medications. As much as you can, decreasing or limiting liquids before bedtime, so maybe within the 2-hour window before bedtime, can help reduce the urinary frequency and urgency or having to get up multiple times per night to use the restroom. But then making sure that you're making up for that during the day. So, you know, if you're supposed to be drinking, you know, 64 ounces of water per day, if that's what your doctor has recommended, trying to get the bulk of that done earlier in the day rather than close to bedtime. Okay. So now I'd like to do a relaxation with everyone. The relaxation exercise that we'll do this evening is called progressive muscle relaxation. I'd like everyone, as best you can, to try to get comfortable wherever you're sitting or laying. And progressive muscle relaxation is an exercise that relaxes your mind and body, essentially by progressively tensing and relaxing various muscle groups. You'll be tensing each muscle group pretty vigorously, but try to do so without straining, and then suddenly releasing the tension and feeling the muscles relax. You'll tense each muscle for about 5 seconds. If you have any pain or discomfort at the targeted muscle group, feel free to omit that one. So you don't need to do every single muscle group, especially if you're feeling, if you are having pain in that area, you can skip that one and focus on ones that feel better for you. So I'd like everyone, again, to get comfortable where you're sitting. Go ahead and just take a few deep breaths. Go ahead and breathe in and out. And allow your attention to focus only on your body. If you begin to notice your mind wandering, bring it back to the muscle you're working on. And now I'd like you to take a deep breath through your abdomen. Hold that breath for a few seconds and exhale slowly. Again, as you breathe, notice your stomach rising and your lungs filling with air. As you exhale, imagine the tension in your body being released and flowing out of your body. Again, let's inhale and exhale. Start to feel your body relaxing. As you go through each of these steps, remember to keep breathing. Breathing is the key for this progressive muscle relaxation. Begin by tightening the muscles in your forehead by raising your eyebrows as high as you can. And hold that for about 5 seconds. And now release that and feel the tension fall away. Each time you release a muscle group, try to release it as abruptly as you can. And you just feel that tension float away and almost a cool sensation flow into the area that was tense. And now I'd like you to try smiling widely, feeling your mouth and your cheeks tense up. And hold that for about 5 seconds. And release. And begin to feel that softness of your face as you release those muscles. Now I'd like you to tighten your eye muscles by squinting your eyelids tightly shut. Hold that for about 5 seconds. And release. And then gently pull your head back as if to look at the ceiling. Don't strain too much, just to get a nice tension. Hold that for 5 seconds. And release. Feel that tension start to melt away. So now we've dealt with several muscle groups just within the face and head and neck. You're probably feeling the weight of your head and neck, and you may feel a sinking feeling in those muscles. Remember to breathe in and out. In and out. You can breathe in through your nose and out through your mouth. However, if you're congested or have a cold at this time of year, it's okay to breathe through your mouth and for both. And now tightly but without straining, I'd like you to clench your fists and hold that position until I say stop. Go ahead and clench your fists. Tight. Tight. And release. Moving up your arms, we're going to work on your biceps. I'd like you to flex your biceps. Get some nice tension in those muscles. Feel the buildup of that tension. And let's go ahead and hold that for 5 seconds. And go ahead and release. And that's one where you may really feel that nice, cool sensation flowing through when you release that muscle. Others may feel it as a warming sensation. But a lot of people describe it as almost like a water or a flowing through the muscle of this nice relaxation. Go ahead and breathe in and out. Now I'd like you to tighten your triceps by extending your arms out and locking your elbows. So kind of like you're doing a Frankenstein impression. And go ahead and hold that for about 5 seconds. And go ahead and release. Moving up our arms now, we'll do our shoulders. I want you to lift your shoulders up as if they could touch your ears, or get them as close to your ears as you can. And go ahead and hold. And release. Feel that heaviness of your shoulders when you release. A lot of us carry a lot of tension in our shoulders, so that one's particularly important. You can do that one a few times if you'd like. Let's go ahead and tense your upper back by pulling your shoulders back as if trying to make your shoulder blades touch. Go ahead and hold for about 5 seconds. And release. And this time we'll tighten your chest by taking a deep breath in, filling your lungs as much as you can. Go ahead and inhale. And as you exhale, blow out all of that tension. Now let's try tightening the muscles in your stomach by sucking in. Go ahead and suck in and hold it for 5 seconds. And release. And by now you should be feeling pretty limp and loose from your stomach all the way up through your arms, your shoulders, and your head. Let's go ahead and move down into your thighs. I want you to tighten your thighs by pressing your knees together as if you were holding a penny between them. Hold for about 5 seconds. And release. And then moving down into your toes. I want you to curl your toes underneath your feet. Hold for about 5 seconds. And release. Now imagine a wave of relaxation slowly spreading through your body, beginning at your head and going all the way down to your feet. Feel the weight of your relaxed body as you breathe in and out, in and out. The transcript of this webinar and our relaxation activity will be available online. But if you're interested in creating your own transcript, again, if you just search Google Progressive Muscle Relaxation, there are some wonderful resources that go through even some more muscle groups. You can do your own variations depending on where you find the most tension in your body. Again, as I said, a lot of us hold our tension in our shoulders or lower back for a lot of individuals as well. You can also record it if you have some way of recording your voice. You can read the transcript into your recorder and then listen back to it as you're falling asleep at night. This is a great way to unwind and relax before you fall asleep and help calm your mind. For some people, if they have neuropathy, you may find some tingling sensations during the exercise. Depending on how uncomfortable it is, you can avoid that muscle group that causes the tingling, or you can just notice the tingling depending on how intense it is. It doesn't necessarily have to be a painful experience, but just noticing the tingling can be actually a mindful exercise as opposed to a relaxation exercise. But that would be a talk for another time. So thank you for participating in that relaxation exercise. I'm happy to answer more questions about that during the Q&A part. But now I'd like to turn it back over to Stephanie so that we can talk about some other issues related to medications and other things that can help with sleep.
Great. Thank you so much, Abby. I know I feel relaxed. I hope a lot of you also got a lot out of that exercise. So I want to hit on a couple other really important topics. So there are a lot of medications and substances that can impact your sleep, and I wanted to do an overview of those tonight. So first on my list are anticholinergics, and these are medications that we use to treat a variety of different things, such as overactive bladder, lung disease, dizziness, diarrhea, even allergy medication. These medications can decrease the REM sleep that you get and cause drowsiness and kind of cognitive fogginess during the day as well. If you're on multiple medications that have anticholinergic side effects, the risk for side effects increases because they're kind of notorious for having drug-to-drug interactions. So that's a really important thing to bring up to your healthcare providers. Stimulants, which we often use, such as modafinil, Provigil, for fatigue and MS, can obviously cause insomnia if you take them too late in the day. So the timing of those types of medications is really, really important. We use corticosteroids to treat MS relapses, and one of their major side effects is insomnia. But the insomnia lasts during the course of the steroids. It's short-lived, and it should go away after the steroids are done and out of your system. So a lot of patients do use prescription strength sleep aids while they're on steroids. Pain and spasticity medications can definitely cause drowsiness throughout the day. So some people aren't able to tolerate high doses of those medications in the mornings or in the afternoons. Blood pressure medication can actually lead to insomnia and restlessness at night. If you're on a diuretic or a water pill to decrease your blood pressure, it can also worsen urinary frequency and nocturia. So if you're already prone to having to get up and use the bathroom a lot during the night, being on one on a diuretic medication can definitely make that worse. Some migraine medication that we use to prevent migraines, which are common in people with MS, can also cause drowsiness. So if the medication that you're on does cause you to be kind of groggy in the morning, you might want to talk to your doctor about switching to something else. Depression and anxiety medication, there are some antidepressants that can actually cause insomnia if they're taken at night. So sometimes if we have a patient who has insomnia and is on one of those medications, instead of having them take that at night, we'll switch it to the morning and see if that actually helps them sleep a little bit better. There are a lot of substances that we use kind of voluntarily as well that can really impact our sleep. Alcohol does make us feel sleepy, but it can actually decrease the restful sleep that we get. So even though it might help you fall asleep, we do recommend not drinking alcoholic beverages right before bed. Tobacco, nicotine, it's a stimulant, and it can have a negative impact on sleep quality. Additionally, people who smoke have a higher incidence of insomnia, sleep apnea, and those jerking limb movements that can cause frequent awakenings at night. Caffeine, which is found in coffee, tea, and soda, can definitely also lead to insomnia if it's consumed too late or too close to bedtime. I also wanted to add that a couple different medications that you might be on can give you kind of strange or vivid dreams at night. So if you're having these really vivid dreams that are really disturbing your sleep, you should talk to your doctor about them and see if any medications that you're on can actually cause that. And somebody had actually brought up restless leg syndrome, I saw earlier. And that's kind of where your legs always feel like they need to move around. And the only way to really get any relief is to get up and walk around. We do have medications that can take the edge off of that. And for some people, those medications completely alleviate the symptoms. But a lot of us have cramping in our legs at night. So sometimes actually drinking tonic water, it has a compound in it called quinine, and that can actually help alleviate leg cramps at night and help you be a little bit more comfortable. Next, I wanted to touch on some environmental and lifestyle factors that can influence our sleep. Room temperature is a big one. So a lot of us are sensitive to temperature. And most experts agree that bedroom temperature between 60 and 67 degrees Fahrenheit is really ideal for going to sleep. A lot of us, I don't know about you guys, but I have really struggled with night sweats and heat sensitivity at night. It makes my symptoms so much worse, and it's something that I'm constantly battling with. And I know a lot of us have the same issue. So I really do try to keep my room temperature nice and down. I'll have a fan on. It's also really important to sleep in cotton, very breathable pajamas. Same thing with your bed linens. Try to avoid synthetic fibers, synthetic fabrics, and make sure you're allowing things to breathe. They also have fans that actually can go at the foot of the bed and they blow under the covers. Or some people find that just putting a pillow down at the end of the bed, at the foot of the bed, allows a little bit more air circulation. And that can actually help. Now, we love our sleeping partners, our partners, our kids, our pets, but sometimes they don't make the best roommates. So if your partners are keeping you awake at night, maybe it's time to kind of examine what you could do in order to get better sleep. We also really love our screens, TVs, tablets, our phones. Those devices all emit light. And light is perceived in an area of the brain called the hippocampus. And what the hippocampus does when it starts to sense less and less light is it says, hey, it must be nighttime. And it sends a message to a gland in our brain that excretes a hormone called melatonin. And melatonin is what regulates our sleep-wake cycle. So what we're doing when we're looking at these screens at night in bed is we're actually telling our hippocampus that it's still daytime. And that can really interfere with your sleep. Now, a lot of phones have this nighttime mode, and it does reduce the blue light on the screens, but it doesn't reduce all light. And any light can really be picked up by the brain and interfere with our sleep. Exercise is a really big topic, too, because it can kind of do both. Exercising during the day, we know, can help you get better sleep at night. But for some people, they get a rush of energy, and kind of a pick-me-up from exercising. So if you do feel a little rush of energy after you exercise, it's recommended that you try to avoid exercising right before bed. Comfort I touched on before with the breathable pajamas and the bed linens, but it cannot be stressed enough. You have to be comfortable in order to sleep. And I talked about symptom management already, but we also can't forget about just the basic stuff. Having a good pillow, a supportive mattress, good quality sheets. These are all things that we really need to pay attention to. If you're waking up with a lot of back pain or neck pain, it probably means that you need a firmer mattress or a new pillow. And really, we should be replacing our pillows regularly to ensure that we're nice and comfortable at night. Daytime naps are also kind of a big issue with MS, right? Because a lot of us are tired throughout the day, and we're fatigued, and we need those periods of rest during the day in order to get through. But if we nap too much, or if our naps go kind of longer than an hour, it can really cut into our nighttime sleep and cause insomnia. So how do we treat sleep dysfunction? And I know we've been touching on this throughout the webinar, but first and foremost, it's identifying and addressing the underlying cause, right? So is this a result of a symptom? Are you uncomfortable because of spasticity or pain? Is this a manifestation of depression or anxiety? Do you have an underlying sleep disorder? So there is a higher incidence of sleep disorder, sleep apnea, restless leg syndrome, in people with MS than in the regular population. And there are other conditions that kind of interfere with our sleep, right? So menopause is one. Thyroid dysfunction is another. There are lots of different endocrine disorders that can interfere with sleep. So sometimes the workup for sleep dysfunction actually involves testing for all of those conditions. So if we've screened you for sleep disorders and we've kind of optimized your symptom management as best you can, then it might be time to start talking about medication. And one thing, I skipped over medication regimen, which is so important. I did not mean to skip over that one. So again, I kind of touched on the antidepressant use. So that's kind of an example. A lot of people are on antidepressants, and they're most often given in the evening. But for a small percentage of people, those antidepressants can actually cause insomnia. So sometimes one simple thing that we can do is switch those medications to the morning and see if that helps. Another instance of how we might adjust medication is if you're taking a pain medication or something like baclofen to reduce your spasticity during the day, we might decrease the dose that you're on during the day and increase the nighttime dose. Gabapentin is another medication that I frequently do this with, where I'll actually have you take lower doses in the morning or in the afternoon and higher doses at night, because a lot of people feel really drowsy during the day with those medications. So back to the over-counter medications. So if we've kind of optimized all of those things and we're ready to start trying maybe a couple more interventions, usually I'll first have somebody try taking a little melatonin at night. And you can get that over-the-counter. And once again, that's the hormone that's released in your brain that kind of regulates our sleep-wake cycle. So if you're considering trying melatonin, I would really encourage you to first talk to your provider about it. And the main reason behind that is because we really don't have a lot of studies specifically looking at the use of melatonin in people with MS. So it is important to kind of dialogue with your provider about that. And as a last resort, we will think about adding prescription sleep aids and sedatives. So much like alcohol, sedative medications can help you fall asleep, but they're not really that helpful in helping you to maintain sleep throughout the night. Additionally, the rule of thumb is that we try to use them for the shortest period of time at the lowest dose possible. And that's because all of these medications do lose their effectiveness over time, and most of them do have the potential to be habit-forming. So we don't want you to become dependent on them in order to sleep. So there are a couple of red flags, and these are general signs that if you look at this list and you see something on there that you have not discussed with your doctor, these are all things that are really important to talk to them about. So that includes excessive daytime drowsiness, loud snoring at night, headaches or vocal hoarseness in the morning, not feeling rested or refreshed after sleeping, or if you're having trouble falling or staying asleep. These things may indicate that you do indeed have a sleep disorder or maybe even an underlying sleep dysfunction that we need to check out and further investigate. And those red flags can help us tip off that it's time to take a look at your medications, at your symptoms, and kind of dive into what's going on. So once again, I really want to thank you for joining us tonight, and I look forward to answering your questions.
Terrific. Stephanie and Abby, thank you so much for this informative webinar. We do have some time for some Q&A. So I'd like to start out with a question to Stephanie by asking, one of our participants noted that her provider ignores her concerns, and so it does no good to bring them up. How do you recommend someone handles really getting their provider to understand that this is an issue that needs to be addressed?
Yeah, and you know, in a perfect world, I would never hear that, right? I would love to hear that all providers are really proactive. But the reality is sometimes there's just so much that we have to cover in a visit, and sleep dysfunction sometimes is not our top priority, and we don't really touch on it as much as we should or as much as we would like to. So if you have brought it up to your provider and you felt like they've really blown you off, what I would suggest is writing down specific red flags. So if you identify with any of those red flags that I listed in that last slide, I would write that down and bring that to their attention. And also bringing in a sleep diary, like the one that Abby went through. You know, it's hard to ignore when a patient comes to you with kind of concrete evidence saying, hey, look, I kept this diary, and I really think that this is something that you and I should tackle. Or if you're not sure what to do about it, who can I go to for help?
Great answer. Thank you for bringing up the sleep diary again. That was a great that's a great resource. Abby, can I ask you, are strange dreams a part of MS? One of our participants had an anxiety attack a week ago, and he's wondering if this is part of the MS experience.
Sure. In general, dreams and abnormal dreams are not part of the MS experience per se. However, certain medications can certainly alter your sleep functioning and your, it's called sleep architecture, so those stages of sleep. So you may find that when you start or stop a new medication, your dreams get kind of strange. We also find that people with MS have a higher risk of anxiety disorders. And if you have MS and maybe a co-occurring anxiety disorder, anxiety can also sometimes affect those dreams as well. So those would be the two culprits that I would look to, not specifically MS as itself.
Terrific. Thank you. Stephanie, we often get asked this on our webinars, and people are curious about medical marijuana. What kind of medical marijuana would you recommend? Is there one just for sleep?
So there's not a lot of data on a particular type of marijuana for sleep. And obviously, marijuana is one of those topics that's rapidly changing and developing. For instance, I went from practicing in the state where medical marijuana was legal, and now I practice in a state where it's not. So we're really kind of bound by the state's laws. And, you know, there's been a lot of data looking into pain and specificity with marijuana, but at this time, we just don't have a lot of data to kind of point to a specific type.
Thank you. Abby, thank you so much for that relaxation exercise. I think that was helpful for anyone with MS or not, and I think it's going to be helpful as I use that in my own life. One of our participants asked if you could expand on how to tense the triceps and the biceps.
Sure. So for the biceps, so that's the muscle that if you imagine like some of it, flex your muscle or show me your muscle, that's usually the muscle that they are describing. And so bringing your forearm toward your shoulder, kind of making that motion, and then just squeezing as best you can. So squeezing your wrist as it's in that position, that will tighten your bicep muscle. The tricep muscle, this is the muscle behind your arm that kind of connects to your underarm. The way I describe it is kind of like a Frankenstein walk. So if you extend one arm or both of your arms straight out in front of you and just kind of push forward as high or as far in front of you as you can, you'll feel that muscle tighten in behind your arms. So that would be a good way to tighten that muscle.
Thank you so much. We did have a question about MS and menopausal hot flashes. Do they combine to complicate or exasperate insomnia?
Oh, definitely. I mean, menopause can set off these hot flashes, and many people with MS are really heat sensitive. So absolutely, hot flashes can definitely worsen symptoms while they're going on and definitely impact your comfort, which we know impacts your sleep overall.
And can you give us a recommendation? I know you've reviewed this in the webinar, but can you give us a recommendation how to handle that?
Sure. I would say if you're struggling with hot flashes with menopause, to talk to your OBGYN or your primary care provider, because there are medications and therapies that we can offer to kind of ease a lot of those symptoms, and they can make you a lot more comfortable.
Terrific. One of our participants noted that they've been recently diagnosed with degenerative disease, which apparently is common in MS patients. Can this affect your sleep?
I can discuss that one. Oh, sorry.
Yeah, sure. Go ahead, Abby. No, please do.
Okay. Sure. So from a pain perspective, degenerative disc disease can often lead to low back pain. And so usually when it's interfering with sleep, it's a pain-related issue. So you may find that getting comfortable in bed is more difficult. And this is where trying different positions, try more side sleeping, for example, instead of on your back, can help ease some of that pressure on your discs. And sometimes there's some orthotic or pillow type devices. If you talk to a physiatrist or sometimes a physical therapist, they can talk about different pillows or other devices you can have in the bed with you to adjust your positioning so that it takes pressure off of your low back and doesn't lead to that pain.
Terrific. A couple of our participants asked about bladder issues and what your suggestions might be to fall back asleep quickly after having to deal with a bladder issue.
So I would really encourage somebody who's had a bladder issue and who's had an interruption in sleep to really utilize that relaxation technique that Abby discussed. Would you agree with that, Abby?
I would. And additionally, with bladder functioning, someone also asked about pelvic floor exercises. So doing even some Kegel exercises, which is it's the muscle where if you're trying to hold your bladder, prevent yourself from going to the bathroom, tensing that muscle and then relaxing can help strengthen that muscle. So that there's some weaker evidence right now. There's not a lot of research, but that could help with some of that urinary frequency issues in the bladder control.
Thank you. One of our participants noted that he sleeps on his back and he wakes up with a dry mouth. Is there anything you can recommend to help with that?
I would say that it's possible that there may be some obstructive sleep apnea that you may want to look into or at least get a sleep study or evaluation for that. That's not an uncommon complaint among people who have some kind of sleep apnea. Again, because the weight could be obstructing your path for air, and it's forcing you to breathe through your mouth instead of through your nose. And there's different devices that can be helpful for encouraging more nasal breathing to reduce the dry mouth.
Yes, and I would definitely add that if you have dry mouth and your partner says that you snore a lot at night, that can also really indicate that you should have a sleep study or at least talk to somebody. You can also try propping yourself up on a pillow or two a little bit, but that definitely usually warrants further investigation.
Terrific. One of the participants asked about sleep apnea. Can you review that again, how you can overcome sleep apnea?
The number one recommended treatment for sleep apnea, particularly obstructive sleep apnea, is a CPAP machine, and that stands for continuous positive air pressure. There's a huge range of these devices, which I didn't go too much into in my discussion, the technology has improved significantly over the past 5 to 10 years. So if you're thinking of a CPAP machine being this really big, clunky, noisy, invasive machine, that may not be the case anymore for you. So that's usually the number one recommended treatment for treating sleep apnea. Also, I get a lot of complaints about how the mask, if someone does use a CPAP, that the mask is not fitted properly. And so I've sent patients back to their sleep specialist, 3 or 4 times to get their mask fitted so that it's least invasive, you can get a good seal, and so that it's not waking you up in the night, because it is pretty invasive sometimes. And, if people end up just kind of taking it off and not using it, there could be a solution. So I really encourage people to go back and tinker with it a lot.
And I would also encourage, if you do have sleep apnea and you do depend on a CPAP machine, a lot of doctors will also work with you to try to lose a little bit of weight and just optimize your overall health. Make sure you're taking good care of your blood pressure, your heart, and your lungs. All those things can kind of minimize your effects. And some people even recover to the point where they don't need as much intervention.
Thank you so much. Stephanie, I did have one question about taking Benadryl at bedtime. Is that something that you would recommend or not recommend?
Benadryl is not meant to be a substance that you use every single day. It's really more meant to be something that you use symptomatically. So when you have a cold or a stuffy nose. So I would not use it on a daily basis without speaking to your doctor first. And Benadryl is an anticholinergic medicine. So that's, if you recall, the type of medication that dries you out. So some people really do feel that it makes you drowsy at night, and that's why it can help you fall asleep. But it may still be lingering in the morning and really make you tired in the mornings, and it might be interfering with a lot of the medication. So a lot of people with MS are already on anticholinergic drugs for bowel or bladder issues, for migraines. So you definitely want to speak to your doctor before adding Benadryl, because like I mentioned, if the more medications that you take that do have those anticholinergic properties, the higher risk you have of having a drug-to-drug interaction and side effects.
Abby, we have a participant who asked about exercise. She noted that she is a very active person and exercises 5 times a week. What is a good way to make sure that she doesn't get too burnt out or is not getting enough sleep?
Gotcha. Well, first of all, that's fantastic that you get that much physical activity. That's certainly more than I get, so I kudos to you. From a burnout perspective, it depends on whether you mean more of a physical burnout or more of a mental burnout, because with pacing, you know, having an exercise routine that you're committed to 5 days a week, maybe that's too much, or maybe it doesn't fit with your lifestyle anymore. So checking in with yourself and saying, okay, you know, what do I really feel comfortable with doing? Maybe even reducing the duration of your exercise, but still keeping it up 5 days a week and maybe doing less intense work during that time or alternating days. That can certainly help with the burnout aspect. And then as far as how to minimize its impact on sleep, it's actually probably more likely to improve your sleep than to interfere, as long as you're not doing it right before sleep. So I usually give a number of about 3 hours that you want to finish your exercise, about 3 hours before your bedtime. For some people, if you really respond with that kind of increased energy after your workout, maybe you want to take it more to 4 or 5 hours before you go to sleep. But that's really the best way to maximize your energy during the day and minimize its impact on your sleep.
Terrific. We discussed earlier in the webinar sleep attack, and one of our participants asked if you could just give us a little review of that.
Sure. That's the nickname I use for when I'm referring to narcolepsy. Again, this is pretty rare in people with MS, and with narcolepsy, it's a sudden, completely uncontrollable urge where your body goes to sleep. For most people with MS, you may feel very fatigued and it's hard to keep your eyes open, but it may not come on as suddenly, for example. So it may be more, you know, you sit down on a couch and then you become very fatigued and sleepy and it's hard for you to stay awake. And that's more of the fatigue that's associated with MS, and it's also likely to be a consequence of maybe insomnia or not sleeping well the night before. So the sleep attacks, so to speak, are more rare. However, if you do find that you're falling asleep, you know, for example, very suddenly and not aware that you're fatigued, for example, that would certainly be something to talk to your provider about, because you certainly would want to rule out something like narcolepsy.
Terrific. Thank you so much. So I think at this point, what I would like to do is, first of all, thank Stephanie and Abby for an informative webinar, and I would like to open the floor to both Stephanie and Abby and say, do you have anything you want to conclude with before we end the webinar? And with that, I would go to Stephanie and ask if you have anything you want to add before we finish up tonight.
No, I think that you did a really great job of covering a lot of different issues, and I encourage, if you still have questions, to reach out to your providers and talk amongst each other and exchange tips, because I find that's always the most valuable thing you can do.
That is a great idea. And Abby, is there anything you would like to conclude with?
Just to echo Stephanie, yes, I'm sorry that we didn't get to everyone's questions. I know that this can be a very individualized problem where people have lots of different kinds of sleep problems. And so I hope that we were able to cover kind of the broad strokes, but for specific questions, I don't know if I'm able to answer back channel, or again, talking to your provider is always my go-to recommendation, and even prioritizing an appointment to say, hey, this appointment, I'd really like to talk about sleep. And usually providers will respond well to that because they know it's such a concern for you.
Great advice from both of you. So that does conclude our webinar tonight, and I would like to inform you before we close of some of the additional resources that you may find informative and helpful. On the CanDo MS website, mskendo.org, you will find archived webinars, e-news, and library articles, including an article, Sleep and MS, Strategies for Improving Your Z's, which was written by Stephanie and Abby. You can also submit a question to the Ask the CanDo team, which will be answered by our team of MS experts. Additional resources can be found through the National MS Society. They publish a wide range of literature. Please visit the nationalmssociety.org for this and other resources provided by the National MS Society. If you enjoyed tonight's webinar, please help us to continue to provide this high-quality learning platform to you at no charge. Help support our webinars with a donation by texting your donation amount to 970-626-6232. So once again, you can text to donate at 970-626-6232. And looking forward to next year, our next presentation in our webinar and telelearning series will be on Tuesday, January 10th at the same time, 8 p.m. Eastern Time. GPS for your MS. Just like a roadmap requires diligent planning and routing, you can best succeed in your journey with MS by mapping out a comprehensive wellness plan with the help of your healthcare team. As a housekeeping note, we are moving to a new webinar platform next month, GoToWebinar. Please feel free to email me at lcoin@mskendo.org if you have any questions about the new platform. As always, you can register for the webinar and telelearning series free of charge at the CanDo MS website, mskendo.org, or the National MS website, nationalmssociety.org. I would ask that you complete the survey that will appear on your computer screen immediately following the webinar. You will also receive a PDF copy of tonight's slides and the sleep diary by email. I would like to thank you, and I hope you have a great evening.